This is Mae Brussel, and it's side two of tape 429, February 22nd, 1980. There's a trial going on right now in Philadelphia that involves a self-confessed mob hitman, Charles Allen. Allen claims that he personally delivered $40,000 to John Mitchell as a gift from Jimmy Hoffa, who was in prison and wanted to get out of prison, and Mitchell was the attorney general. The trial has to do with it's a racketeering trial of Francis J. Sheeran, president of the Teamsters Local in Wilmington, Delaware. And Allen has been spieling about killing five or six people for the Watergate defendants, for the White House team that were all removed from office at the time that Nixon was cleaned out. And he's mentioned in the trial that he was paid by Sheeran to commit murder and arson and other crimes for them. And the same day that one of these stories came out was February the 12th this last week. Hoffa's aide suggests a payoff to John Mitchell, and it goes in some more into the payoff to Mitchell. Right below it, it says, U.S. probes underworld tentacles in Las Vegas, which I mentioned earlier, the casino skim money having to do with Kansas City, St. Louis, Milwaukee, and Las Vegas skimming money. And then the John Mitchell story that has been carrying on quite a while, this fellow's been breaking it, is right there along with the underworld story. Now, this man is a hitman who says he's done murders for the Watergate defendants, and I'm sure he didn't do them alone, and it would be very interesting to know all 33 of the informers that were in the Santa Fe, New Mexico jail that were purposely slain to protect, in quotes, their country, because if Robert Bork was there, he worked directly with Robert Haldeman and John Ehrlichman and Richard Nixon and John Mitchell and the entire Watergate team that, again, were linked with Teamsters and William Taub and that whole ball of wax that I've been talking about for many weeks. So that the New Mexico riot, where these people were so terribly mutilated and tortured and killed, and some of the people, the guards and spectators, watched outside with binoculars and didn't even come in till every single one of the people on a particular wing had been murdered. I think it is directly linked to some of the story that's breaking, but we'll have to pursue further to get the list of the names, but even the names alone wouldn't mean anything. Imagine if you had a few people like this Allen, who's testifying now, Charles Allen, if you have them on a cell, you'd eliminate all this information that keeps pouring out. And we will be updating mysterious deaths, drug-related deaths that will be pouring out, because in addition to those deaths in New Mexico, there will be many, many more. In Mountain View, in California, there was the death of a mysterious Douglas Battaglia. He moved up here near Palo Alto recently and opened up a Dynatron Components Incorporated in Mountain View. And he was with a woman from Las Vegas. His family said they didn't know her. She came from Las Vegas, and she was found stabbed cruelly 25 times, shot twice, once in the head and once in the neck. And in trying to find out the cause of this death, they found some lethal ingestion of an unknown toxic substance in the stomach of Battaglia. They're trying to say it was a murder-suicide. But again, she was from Vegas. He was in an electronics firm that had just moved up to the Bay Area from L.A. And these terrible kind of mutilation deaths could be related to the scandals breaking at this time. So it's important to save the articles and later see if there's confessions on possible links to these stories. Another man that died the very day that the story broke, his name is Michael Zaffaroni, and he's supposed to be one of the country's major traffickers in pornography. And he died the very night that the story broke about the photographs of him in the probe of the FBI investigation. He was one of the main suspects, and the night that he was to be arrested, he died of a heart attack. I hope I get time in the near future to outline or chart for you the difference in the drug traffic since the Vietnam War and when the Shah was in Iran and when the Shah left January 79 and how the narcotics increased in this country and that opium and heroin are pouring in and how the traffic route was changed through Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Turkey. And with the Soviet Union coming down to Afghanistan, they interrupted this tremendous narcotic traffic pattern. And this is one of the reasons this multi-billion dollar business that's being upset. And I believe it's one of the reasons for a reaction of so many people to the venture that the Soviet Union did into Afghanistan at this time. The type of article that makes me believe that this is going on, I do have so many of them. A typical one, and one of the newest to come out, was last week in the Washington Post, Friday, February the 8th, 1980. The title of the story, the big story, is Iranian turmoil is fueling a surge of heroin here. This is in Washington, D.C., the Washington Post. The political upheaval in Iran resulted in a major increase in smuggling to Washington and to all the major cities in the United States. The end result, especially noticeable in the Washington area, is higher quality heroin for sale to addicts. The law enforcement officials attribute the recent increase in smuggling from Iran to the ease and accessibility of heroin and the ability of smugglers to leave the country. And it goes into the statistics of the overdoses in New York, 34 so far in this past year, and in the medical problems and the hospital problems and in the arrests, the law enforcement that goes with this. And it goes into the quality of heroin that's coming in, and it says the emphasis has shifted. First, it was from Southeast Asia, then the Mexican heroin, and now it's shifted from the Southeast Asia, and it seems to be coming from Iran. The increased smuggling is the Iranian heroin that was cut off this last year, the Southeast Asia, and switched to the Iran heroin that was coming through to this country. The U.S. drug enforcement have trouble with the Iranian machinery and the government, and the drug smuggling is now coming in the hands of small-time smugglers instead of the huge operations. And I mentioned before that the Shah's sister has been linked to large narcotic operations, the Shah of Iran, and the government officials. And one of the big problems in rearranging the traffic pattern is that it's now in the hands of the smaller, like the mom-and-pa grocery stores, the small-time smugglers are pouring this stuff in. This article says the Iranian heroin had reached England last summer, and anticipating its arrival in the United States soon, it is here now. And it goes into the big increase in, the admissions to the jails and the addicts and the quality. They can tell by the blood test what's coming in. Now, one of the persons that they arrested in Washington, D.C., there was a big arrest, and it had to do with a man who has a restaurant in the Chevy Chase part of town called the West End Restaurant. This is from the New York Times. They arrested the man who has this restaurant. The owner is, his name is Mohammed Rosham, and he went before the federal judge and asked that the bond be reduced and that he be released in the custody of two friends. And one of his friends was a former Central Intelligence Agency employee. Well, I don't believe there are formers, but it's interesting that the man that was involved in this huge narcotic operation was to be released to the custody of the CIA man. And I mentioned way back on the tapes that one of the reasons the Shah was so nicely eased out of Iran with the help of Jimmy Carter and the Central Intelligence Agency was that they would have a clear-cut narcotics traffic pattern that they could take care of. And there were several people arrested with him, two other people. But the main owner of the restaurant was to be released to the custody of an agent from the Central Intelligence Agency. Another article in the Washington Post about uncut heroin, 7 pounds from Iran. The suspected dealers are caught, and this is from the Washington Post, February the 6th. The man who had the restaurant and who was arrested only had what the Drug Enforcement Agency called was $32 million value. It had a street value, these 7 pounds, of $32 million. There was a down payment promised of $5 million. There was $5 million in a safe deposit at LaFont Plaza, a branch of the National Bank of Washington. There is a lot of money in the narcotics, and there's been a lot of money since the Shah moved out and a new group came in. And as much as anything else, there is a drug war going on. The Washington Post also goes on to say the Drug Enforcement Administration officials reported recently that their troubles were increased by the amount of drugs coming in from what they called the Golden Crescent. Golden Crescent is Iran, Afghanistan, and Pakistan, the global trouble spot that is also the world's largest producer of opium used to manufacture heroin. So you see, if the Soviet Union just marches into a totally illiterate, terribly devastated country like Pakistan, whose feudal system is mainly supported by keeping women down and as slaves and high illiteracy and no education or intelligence, and a few feudal lords doing their dope dealing, you can see how the Soviet Union could fracture the economy in the United States, in Harlem and Washington and St. Louis and Los Angeles and Miami and every major city in the United States and in Europe, if they cut off that drug problem drastically with the Soviet troops. You could see what this would do to a lot of people, particularly a man in Washington, D.C., who just has one simple amount, a $32 million package right there in his hands. Multiply that all over the world. I can't even begin to guess the billions of dollars in narcotic traffic that has altered since the Shah of Iran is out. I've done many tapes on Michael Sindona. He was a chief banker for the Vatican, starting with Pope Paul VI, and I won't update you on those. You can go back to earlier tapes on Sindona. He was to go to trial for his case at Franklin Bank in New York City. There was $45 million misappropriated. That's a nice word for stealing or a bank robbery. When you're very rich and you're a millionaire, you call it a misappropriation of $45 million, the defunct Franklin National Bank. Sindona was to go to trial in September and was missing for a while and then reappeared. This is the Michael Sindona that is linked to the Banca Unione in Milan, Italy, and to the Vatican. He was given a large amount of money for the Vatican to invest in the United States and all over the world, and the money is tied into the Carlo Gambino family and organized crime. So Sindona is a pretty heavy dude to be going to trial, and last week his attorney asked that he be given special privileges, Sindona, because of his influence and power in Italy. Frankel had gone to Rome, that's his attorney, Marvin E. Frankel, a lawyer for Sindona. And he went to Vatican. He spoke to the people in Rome shortly before the trial, according to the New York Times, and asked two cardinals and an archbishop to give videotaped testimony as a character witness for Mr. Sindona. He wanted the Vatican to speak up for this guy who was absconding $20 million here and $30 million there, $30 million of unauthorized money, a loss in banks in Italy, and the Vatican is out about $90 million. And they wanted a character witness in the terms of legal people, two cardinals and an archbishop, and the Vatican refused. The Vatican Secretary of State ruled out that it would set a bad precedent for them to testify on behalf of Mr. Sindona, even though he was a financier who had wealth and power, described in the New York Times, and had been the financial advisor to both Italian politicians and the Vatican. The Vatican reneged on sending people to give character statements, videotapes for Mr. Sindona. And furthermore, at the time that the story was breaking of the links of Senator Murphy in New York and his contacts with the Gambino family, and earlier the story of Mr. Sindona from the Vatican with his links to the Carlo Gambino family, just at the time that the one story was breaking, the story of Abscam and Congressman Murphy and his possible links to the Carlo Gambino family, Mr. Sindona was slapped into jail. He's been out on a $3 million bail all this time, even though he had disappeared for a while, and he came back. And the New York Times said there was no announced reason for revoking the bail, but it had something to do with his disappearance, and they thought maybe he secretly had traveled out of the country. Maybe he had gone to the Vatican, and they slapped him into jail, which is where he is right now, while the other Abscam and other drug-related, politician-related, congressional-related incidences are breaking. Sindona, who's very political, who has links to the crime, to the organized crime, to the Vatican, to Nixon, to the committee to re-elect the president, to John Mitchell, the whole ball of wax, the very time that all these stories are breaking, they took Sindona and slapped him off the streets and put him in the clinker, and that's where, as I say, he is at this time. I've done many tapes on Jimmy Carter and the links to organized crime and the narcotic connections. I'll have to total them all up in one big tape or two or three tapes sometime instead of a little bit each week. But there are continuous links of him to the drug connections, and they could be the explanation of why at the time he allowed the Shah of Iran to be removed, because it did open up a whole new narcotics market, and people that have put Jimmy Carter into power may be appreciating some of the profits, such as that gentleman that has the restaurant in Washington, D.C. I don't know how many links there are, but they just kept up over and over again. Jimmy Carter appointed Cecil Andrus to become Secretary of the Interior. He used to be governor of Idaho. When he first was governor in Idaho, he appointed a Sheriff John Bender to be head of the law enforcement, and people are outraged at the selection of Bender, and LEAA said you couldn't have him. And there was mention then at the time that Andrus took money from a mob-connected racetrack cartel, and there were a lot of questions about organized crime in Idaho, and the FBI was to do checks on Andrus, and they were also looking into the appointment of Bender in as a sheriff there in Idaho. This is similar to Raymond Pecunier being deputy sheriff in San Francisco, with high important links to tentacles of government and intelligence throughout this state and nationally. Well, Jack Anderson's article, February the 15th, 1980, he tells how the files of Bender's appointment were locked up, the investigative file, but when they got into them later, it contained serious allegations about Andrus himself, that he had taken campaign contributions from organized crime figures, probably through the Emprise Corporation. Well, when you hear the name Emprise, it should ring a thousand bells. It's like seeing Rosebud on Citizen Kane's sled. Emprise is a national organization that was named by reporter Don Bowles at the time his car was blown up and he was murdered. Just before he died, he said Emprise got him. They're noted crime figures from the Northwest and Canada and Phoenix and New Mexico, the Southwest, all around the country. Emprise is a large, well-known group of mobsters, and in the files of Mr. Andrus, who's now our Secretary of the Interior, was information about donations and contributions from organized crime, and that's the man that Jimmy Carter appointed to a cabinet position. For the remaining part of this tape, I'm going to be talking about Jonestown and Colonia Dignidad in Chile, a new article by Charles Krauss in the Washington Post on Colonia Dignidad. But alongside that is another article, Washington Post, February the 13th. This past week, California's Asian communities are seething with crime. Well, there are many people from Vietnam who have brought in millions of dollars, $3 million here, $4 million there, $20 million here, $40 million. And I know this for a fact personally through people who are familiar with these agents. They're buying hotels in the Bahamas. Well, I don't want to reveal any secrets. There was somebody in the area here that was going to buy a large piece of land and a compound, a person from Vietnam, that brought over a lot of money. I understand Premier Ki from Vietnam came over with $40 million in gold. The Vietnamese members of the Central Intelligence Agency that were allowed to fly out, part of the Phoenix program, the terror program, left with millions of dollars. And now the links of organized crime and drug and narcotics traffic have increased tremendously. This article in the Washington Post goes into a lot of the opium connections and the Thai connections and the California Asian communities that are seething with the influx of these people into the California area, bringing drugs from Southeast Asia. Not, again, the Marseille connections, but coming right up into California with their contacts. And I think that's important in terms of bringing Asians to this country. Who is getting out? Which ones are getting out? The anti-Castro Cuban community that was into narcotics, prostitution, child prostitution, and syndicate and mob in Cuba were kicked out with Batista. And when Fidel Castro came in, the worst elements of Cuba came into the United States and formed the anti-Castro Cubans that set up so much violence and bombing and terrorism in the United States and our literal army for the Central Intelligence Agency. The white Russians that left the Soviet Union when it became the Soviet Union, the Tsarists, the Solidarists, the Vaslov's army, brought assassination techniques, torture, massacre, counterintelligence, terrorism, agents provocateurs, brought all that to the French and taught it to them and taught it to the Germans and formed the armies of Adolf Hitler after the revolution. We get a certain percentage in this country of the not-so-desirables who were kicked out of their own country because they were cruel and corrupt, and just like our early founding fathers were men let out of prison. If they came to this country, they'd let them out of England. So we have elements here that are the degenerate aristocracy of their particular places, and when you get the Asians, and you get the Cubans, and you get the white Russian elements and the Nazis, and you bring all these people into this country, you get a boiling pot of corruption and crime and mass murders and terrorism. And what we're feeling now are pockets of these people coming into this country, and they also have raided their territories with all the gold and counterfeiting and treasures that they can take when they leave. New article in the paper this week, Jonestown may be settled with refugees from Laos, 750 primitive Laotian tribesmen and 750 refugees from Dominica, from the Caribbean island. The son of Billy Graham, Franklin Graham, wants to bring into Guyana, with Prime Minister Burnham's administration, $2 to $6 million project to bring in persons with their airfare from Thailand to Guyana to take over Jonestown. Now, this one article in the Los Angeles Times describes that these people worked with the Central Intelligence Agency. They fought against the Laotian communists. They got support from the CIA. And now they're being brought to Guyana. Mr. Jagan was removed, and he was a socialist or even maybe a communist, and he was in charge of the government in Guyana, and Burnham was put in by the Central Intelligence Agency. So now the religious groups want to bring over Laotians and members of the Phoenix Program and the intelligence program into Guyana, and then within 5 years, the article says, they become citizens, and they can take over all the politics of Guyana or the native population and be very useful with their Phoenix-type operation to control the politics of Guyana. One of the few countries that is wobbly, that isn't a total dictatorship, but the present administration was put in by the CIA. Burnham was supposed to have elections this year and canceled the elections, and now he'll get millions of dollars to come in on a 25-year basis. They'll lease the land, and it will be part of four Christian relief agencies bringing in specific people that work with the Central Intelligence Agency that they're now going to get ready to move in to Jonestown. President Carter was photographed in the Washington Post last April 25th, 1979, almost a little less than a year ago. His eyes closed, and he was standing next to Elie Wiesel, a man that had been at Auschwitz and survived the concentration camps. And the Washington Post has a story under the picture in large letters. It said, "The world knew and kept silent, a memorial to the Holocaust forgotten by the unforgetting." And the article tells how the President and Congress set aside a memorial because they said that people should not forget what happened in the past, that a lot of people were helped in London, Moscow, and Washington, but not the Jews, and the truth is that they were forgotten. The world knew and kept silent. This article says that the world knew what was going on in the concentration camps, and that the lesson of the Holocaust should be to commemorate the victims of the Holocaust by being outraged and promising to banish all human oppression from the world. Now, that's a nice goal, to banish oppression, and Jimmy Carter tells how he grieved when he was in Israel and saw books row after row with names of people that were murdered, and he said, in quotes, "I vowed then, as people all over the world are doing this week, to reaffirm our unshakable commitment that such an event will never recur on this earth again." A perfect example of knowing and keeping silent was Jimmy Carter's Central Intelligence Agency, FBI, and State Department that knew that over 900 to 1,200 people were going to die in Jonestown or were dying, and they waited 3 or 4 days till the bodies were decomposed and not recognized to come in, and Carter stayed aloof, and they have not investigated it, and the world keeps silent about Jonestown, tries to keep silent, and when you take 10 or 20 people that are killed, or 30 or 40, and then you go to the 900s or 1200s, the next is the 20,000s, the 30,000s, and then it gets into the millions. Charles Krauss has a long article and a map on Colonia Dignidad, located in Chile, bordering to Argentina, outside of a town called Parral, 200 miles below Santiago in Chile. I first learned about Colonia Dignidad in Ladislaus Fargo's book, Aftermath, and I've mentioned it many, many times on the tapes pertaining to different stories of Nazis and Nazi money that came out of Germany and seclusion and protection in South America, and also in Colonia Dignidad. The magazine Counterspy had an article December 78, but it was written before the Jonestown came down. Jonestown happened in November of 78, and the article was printed, so it was written one or two months before Jonestown, and maybe the author, Conrad Eeg, didn't even know there was a Jonestown, because there was no connection between what was written in Counterspy with what was written in Fargo's book. And Amnesty International had a report on Colonia Dignidad in 1975. I have a copy of it here, and I'll give you an address of where you can order it. But evidently, that wasn't written up in Counterspy, or the details of the torture and what was going on in Chile. The connections certainly weren't being made to Jonestown, because everything at that time was supposed to be ideally hunky-dory and a lot of agricultural community development for people who couldn't stand the streets of the cities of the United States, or involved with drugs and arrests or poverty, and this was going to be the home and haven for most of these black people run by white people. And there wasn't much known about Jonestown at the time. I did the tapes in April of 1979 on Colonia Dignidad. There's tape 385, 386, 387, comparing Jonestown to Colonia Dignidad. And then later I did a story on the tapes for you of Jack Anderson's, talking about Operation Condor, assassination teams coming out of Chile, Colonia Dignidad. The Condor three-part operation involved assassins and assassination teams. And of course, Jim Jones had programmed these people with signed confessions that they were assassins. And the House Foreign Relations Committee has admitted there's about 150 assassins out loose from Jonestown. And the Operation Condor takes place at this agricultural farm in Chile. Also, a recent article on Nazi organization down there. Jack Anderson had another article, and I've referred to it several times. And also on a tape, 379, a book, Treason for My Daily Bread. It goes into Martin Bormann and assassination teams in South America and their links of the Nazis to the assassination of John Kennedy. Well, just this week, this past week, Charles Krauss began a long story. As I said, we'll just barely get into it on this tape, and I'll promise to do more next week. And you might get the Washington Post and photocopy it if you can. And he describes this colony. He went down there last December, and he met people in town in San Diego. And one of the men in San Diego said that when I read about Jim Jones in Jonestown, I thought immediately of Colonia Dignidad in San Diego. That's what a diplomat told Charles Krauss. Now, Krauss did a book and articles on Jonestown. He was sent down there by the Washington Post right after the deaths. He was the fellow that was on the plane with Mark Lane going down to Jonestown. And he did write a great deal about Jonestown. And it's interesting that in that 1 year after Jonestown in 1978, November, December of 78, that he went down to Colonia Dignidad in 1979, December, and he's writing the story now, a few months later, and he went to the border of Colonia Dignidad. They took his film away and confiscated it, and there's no way he could get in. It's an isolated, private place that you cannot get on the grounds or speak to anybody, and the people can't leave there. On the tapes that I did, three tapes, I compared Jonestown to Colonia Dignidad. And I want to go over some of the points of his article here. One important thing that he mentions, there's a section here about a man who left Germany and went to Canada and Indiana, which is again where Jim Jones came from Indiana. His man's family went to Jonestown, his sister-in-law's wife's sister and the husband, and then they had five children. One branch of the family went to Canada and Indiana, and the other one went down to Colonial Dignidad in Chile. And he claims that this Paul Schaefer, who was in the Nazi Germany Air Force, started organizing for the Chilean community called Colonia Dignitat in West Germany in 1952. 1952 was the year that Evita Perón died prematurely, and according to Farrago, released out of four banks the multi-million dollar investment that the Nazis had put away to resurge and rebuild the Fourth Reich. There isn't enough time on this tape. I wanted to update you on some of those other stories, and I did want to spend a lot of time on this Nazi commune and the Chilean military junta and the congregation of Nazis down there and torture that's going on constantly in Chile at the present time. When we talk about human rights and the president is running again for re-election, he should be approached on the matter of Colonial Dignidad. I think it's important for all of us that we expose what is going there and their links to Jonestown. Every presidential candidate and every member of Congress should be provided with information. As Charles Krauss says in the article, the lead story, Colonial Dignidad, nobody comes and nobody goes, and he's been down there and he describes it as a concentration camp. Our time is out again. This is Mae Brussel. I'm sorry the tape is so short. I wish we could do more. We'll be back together next week. Take care of yourselves, and I'll be with you next week.